my great pleasure indeed to introduce a man who, by this point, probably doesn't need much introduction. Dilip Lunda is our Shiv Dasani Fellow for the term. Very great scholar of Advaita Vedanta, and today he'll speak to us about the meaningfulness or the meaninglessness of ritual, Vedic ritual as renunciation.
Can I have some water, if possible?
If I give you my email address, would that be rude to ask if you could email your lecture notes?
It is coming out. I think in next week it will be online in the Journal of Hindu Studies. The basic, exactly there, it's an expanded version of that lecture.
I
will send you an email just
because I was discussing it on the phone with some sannyasinis.
Okay.
And they said, bring it with you when you come.
I'll send. Because some corrections are being finalized. So next week it will be the final version online. I'll just tell you that it is there. You can just go through. You can give more your remarks. It will be very much pleased to be there.
I'm a lay person. I'm not an academic.
No, that's good. I was wondering the same thing, actually.
I don't know what it means, lay. If it is non-academic, but it may be from what we call confessional and devoted spaces. And for me, that's paramount. I just understand that. I noted your last question in the first meeting.
Yeah.
I think it was something like for the Western tradition to admit that. And I mentioned about Pierre Hadouille and Foucault also, though his understanding perhaps is quite defective, about the need to change and transform oneself to access truth. That's the basic presumption that we are talking about. So I think last time I read a long paper, and in fact I don't know, I went beyond the time I had. So this time I will diminish a little bit the size of the paper. And I'm going to be as simple as I can as far as the understanding of ritual is concerned, and particularly its organic connections and relations to what we call moksha. So I will read the paper, but I will hope that it will feel free, since it will be a less longer paper to perhaps for short questions to even stop during, and then to entertain a discussion. For the sake of brevity and conciseness, I would prefer to read. So the main thrust of my lecture today is to show that systematic, deliberate, and gradual renunciation, here I'm using the word tyaga as a general word for renunciation, constitutes in Indian traditions in general, and in the Vedic traditions in particular, the main feature of what we may call a religious or spiritual outlook, in contrast with what we may call a mundane outlook. We will also show that renunciation is ultimately purposeful in enabling one to overcome suffering through gradual immersion into the knowledge of the deepest levels of one's immediate reality. Therefore, instead of drawing apart one from reality, knowledge-driven renunciation is that which brings one definitely closer to reality, by eliminating one's recurrent errors about it, by redefining the nature of one's interaction and relationship with the world, and by developing one's sense of responsibility and compassion. Perhaps no text could illustrate better those principles than the dialogue between Yajnavalkya and Maitreyini in the fourth part of the second chapter of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Now, in the Vedic tradition, the religious or spiritual process above outlined can be basically framed in two major steps of the ladder towards realization. Dharma, the ritual-driven tradition associated with oral and written Brahmanas, and moksha, or the knowledge-driven tradition associated with oral and written Upanishads. In his commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, Shankaracharya states that these two dimensions of the Vedic path, he calls the path of ritual engagement, pravritti, and the path of reflexive contemplation, nivritti, are organically integrated. It is a well-established fact, and I here quote Nakamura's, quote means mention, Nakamura's comprehensive work about the origins of Vedanta, that this twofold dimension, obviously it's widespread in the Indian context, understood as an integrated organic whole, wherein the first, means dharma, stands as a long-term prerequisite for the second, moksha, was in place since early days. In other words, dharma and moksha are intrinsic constitutive stages of a gradual religious path. in a terminology more akin to Western traditions, we could designate the stage one as moral religion and the stage two as mystical religion. That organic articulation stands in sharp contrast with the modern interpretative tendencies, certainly inspired by Christian perceptions of an evolution from Old to New Testament, that look at them as mutually excluding terms within an historical chronological sequence. For instance, the idea that Shankar was a critic and against ritualistic or ritual tradition in general. Conversely, in the Indian Vedic tradition, the religious dynamics that prompts the transition from dharma to moksha corresponds to an enlargement of horizons rather than a substitution of horizons. In fact, the critical perspective that arises of one's pursuance of moksha, as per the Upanishadic and Vedantin tradition, is an outcry for a deeper understanding of dharma rather than its negation. And similarly, the emergency of dharma, as expressed in the Brahmana and Samrit literature, is understood as well as an enlargement of the horizons pertaining to kama and artha, rather than their negation. One could therefore speak of a three-level structure of the Purushartha doctrine, wherein dharma, the stage one of religion, stands as an in-depth resignification of artha and kama. And moksha, the stage or level two of religion, stands as an in-depth resignification of dharma, that is, an in-depth resignification of dharma's in-depth resignification of artha and kama. In other words, kama and artha, that is, the mundane level of one's existence, contains in itself, in a raw and blurred way, the totality of one's existence that are to be clarified by the double-fold intervention of the religious process. As such, the transition from mundane to religious is one of perspective rather than of reality. And this is precisely what underscores the nature of the teleological condition of liberation in Vedic tradition, the Jivan Mukta, that is, liberated in life, in this world, here and now. That's also the sense in which in Vaishnava Bhakti traditions, for example, the notion of prema as the supreme moksha stands at the highest understanding of kama, artha. Thus, the two levels of in-depth resignification of reality that constitute the Vedic religion, dharma and moksha, have renunciation, and more specifically, renunciation of erroneous perspectives, we call it avidya, rather than erroneous realities, as their fundamental enabling factor. In other words, renunciation constitutes the behaviorally and disciplinary facet of a correlate process of incremental knowledge about reality that fosters, in specific circumstances, the elimination of errors regarding the true nature of things. In both levels, dharma and moksha, fundamental, definitive concepts or practices, as much as their overall literature, speak unequivocally about their imminent renunciatory character. Dharma is made concrete through the systematic practice of yajñas, a word derived from the root yaj, that points to the act of offering or sacrificing something of one's possession. And moksha is realized through the practice of sannyasa, a word derived from the root as, yaj means to throw, that points to the act of giving or casting away. Here it means, you have to understand because of the prefix sam, everything. Is an idea here of completeness of what is relinquished. The etymology and actual meaning of both the words, yajna and sannyasa, correlate of dharma and moksha, points to a major difference between these two dimensions of renunciation, tyaga, at stake. Dharma as ritual implies a fundamentally a renunciation of actual possessions or actual habits, leaving relatively intact the notion of I as an agent. Accordingly, the act of renunciation is subjectively justified by the expectation of a future acquisition of a transcendent object, the paradise. It's therefore a partial renunciation that hits primarily the dimension of mind, mama, of one's self-identification or ahankara, and its correlate idea of reality as a sort of privatized substantive otherness. Moksha as a reflexive contemplation implies fundamentally the renunciation of one's notion of being an agent, and consequently of any sort of residual accusatory expectation. It's a total renunciation that hits primarily the dimension of I, of one's self-identification or ahankara, and its correlate idea of reality as substantive otherness. I use the word sometimes duality, I mentioned already in the previous talk, as substantive otherness. I mean, the question for me is not how many are there in the Vedantic tradition, in the different schools, if it is one or many. The question is that if I take reality as substantive or not, or the different elements of reality. As it will become clear ahead, the renunciatory aspect of Dharma constitutes in the long term of a transmigratory process involving a plurality of deaths and rebirths, an indispensable stage towards the renunciatory aspect of moksha. In both the cases, renunciation opens the way for a gradual unveiling of the underlying non-dual, I'm putting here the all possibilities, non-dual, dependent, swatantra paratantra, or interdependent character of reality. It could include here pratityasamutpada, for example, the Buddhist core. So all these would be possibilities of an understanding something which pervades the totality of the real and therefore which would prevent the concept and the idea of substantive otherness. Therefore, in the both cases, Dharma and Moksha, knowledge and renunciation are intrinsic to their nature. If we then classify the first, Dharma, as primarily karma and pravritti, that's why we call it a karma kanda, that's because it prompts only a partial renunciation, leaving intact the agent as the epicenter of interested actions. Whereas when we classify moksha primarily as jnana and nivritti, that's because it prompts a total renunciation, which eradicates the centrality of the agent, leaving no room for interested actions. In both the cases, the centrality of renunciation as part of a gradual process of elimination of errors regarding the ever-present reality leaves no room for doctrinal reifications or even representations of transcendent realities. The discourse aimed at the ritual deals with a method of action, yajna, conducive to the acquisition of a not previously existing object, the paradise. We'll see it later. Whereas a discourse aimed at the reflection deals with a method of thinking that seeks the realization of the ultimate nature of reality as either ontological non-difference, ontological dependence, or ontological interdependence between Brahma and Atma. That corroborates the non-dogmatic and transformational character of the whole complex of religious oral textual tradition in India. The complex combination in Dharma between subjective expectations of future results, on the one hand, and renunciation and its correlate knowledge of reality, on the other, tends to obscure the precise features of the latter. It means which type of renunciation is at stake. And the reason as to why, in the final analysis, it should be construed as a paramount feature of Dharma, renunciation, for its being an indispensable factor leading to the pursuance of moksha. In this lecture, I will concentrate precisely on those specific characteristics and modalities of renunciation in the pursuance of Dharma, as presented in the fundamental Vedic texts, such as the Brahmanas, the Kalpa Sutras, and the Mimamsa Sutras. Much of the references here I have dropped, no? But any person would be interested in a complete version of the article, I can just mention them. The relevance of these Vedic sources lie in their being descriptive of some of the fundamental structures and matrices that conditions the dynamic process of Hinduization, as Harold Arnold calls it. It means that I'm also interested in studying this structure of Dharma as renunciation, seeing it as something which somewhat comes from what we call older times, but it is a kind of archetypical structure which also pervades today's practices in India. I'll take initial help and inspiration from modern Indologist and Vedic ritual expert Fritz Stoll's seminal article, The Meaninglessness of Ritual. Through controversial exegetical ways, and I'll put it ahead, Stoll puts forward a magnificent insight into the major dimensions of what is at stake in traditional Vedic ritual procedures. In my understanding, Stoll's characterization of ritual as meaninglessness involves two fundamental ideas. First, ritual does not ultimately target any external goals. That is, it exists for its own sake rather than for something else. And second, it does so because it prompts the ultimate renunciation of whatever external goals it may circumstantially entertain. In other words, Stoll seems to suggest that renunciation is an essential and not an incidental feature of ritual. This extraordinary insight risks, however, to be significantly misunderstood in regard to what actual modalities of renunciation it points to on account of an exegetical mistake. Another way of putting it is that Stoll did it right through the wrong way. The exegetical passage of stake, which is decisive for Stoll's position, constitutes one of the most explicit syntheses of Vedic literature of the renunciatory character of dharmic ritual. In the Katyayana Shrauta Sutra, the author states that yajna, the sacrifice, is made of three basic elements: the offerings, dravya, the objects the sacrificer is bound to offer; the deities, devata, the receptacles of those offerings; and renunciation, tyaga, the act of renouncing itself. Now, the controversy lies in the precise contents of the renunciation mentioned last. What exactly is to be renounced? For Stoll, the passage would stand for renunciation of the expected fruits of the ritual, which, in accordance with the dharmic literature in general, stands for the acquisition of paradise, svarga, in next life, paratra, and is stood as the putative goal of all Vedic rituals and objectively emblematic of one's search for happiness. This posture of the Vedic texts about the ritual follows the well-known statement, both in the Brahmanas and the Shrauta Sutras, stating that one who desires the paradise should perform the ritual. Svarga kamo yajeta, largely corroborated by Jaimini's standard definition of the ritual as, he says, a sequence of actions that originates from the injunctions, chodana or vidhi, enunciated in the Vedas, whose result is paradise, something coveted by all. And Sabara, the commentary of Jaimini, goes to the extent of classifying the desire as a criteria of eligibility for the ritual. He says, the ritual imperative makes the sacrifice prescribed by the Vedic texts concerning those whose eligibility is founded in the desire for paradise. The criterion of such eligibility, that is, the desire for paradise, is therefore clearly established. Stoll is not unaware of the unavoidable contradiction involved in the idea that, on the one hand, Vedic injunctions text, according to him, would exhort one into ritual action as a means to satisfy one's subjective desire for paradise, and on the other would posit the need for one to renounce to the same desire while actually performing the ritual. His reference to the Bhagavad Gita, Karma Phala Tyaga, positing sannyasa as the ultimate dimension of tyaga, as a possible subliminal renunciatory model, further complicates the matter. In the article, he immediately after interpreting the tyaga of the Sarota Sutras as of the fruits of the ritual, it means the svarga, he also adds or glosses with the Karma Phala Tyaga of the Bhagavad Gita 12.2. So this further complicates the matter in my understanding. So in addition to an outright disqualification of one's subjective desire, which without which there is no ritual, Stoll blurs dangerously the difference between dharma as partial renunciation and moksha as complete and definitive renunciation, which is what the Bhagavad Gita somewhat refers to, moksha, still, he sticks to that twisted exegesis in order to corroborate his fundamental insight about the meaninglessness of ritual, understood as an act that stands for its own, that is ultimately free from any subsequent external or extrinsic goals. As stated above, I'm sympathetic with Stahl's basic insight on the ultimate self-reliability of ritual and its actual content, or shall we call it intrinsic meaning as existential renunciation. I think this is a fantastic insight of Stahl. There is a dimension of self-reliability in ritual, and the content of that self-reliability is existential renunciation. That would interestingly lend a more accurate justification to the fact that, different from karma and artha, whose designation reflects the actual object of desire, dharma is designated after the means to attain its corresponding desire. It means the purusharta should have been the paradise, not dharma. In other words, dharma stands for a means, which therefore has to have some kind of extraordinary sense as also a goal of human existence. That's why it is classified as a purusharta. Here and now, in perfect agreement with my earlier suggestions, that not only moksha as a disobjectifying desire for no desire, but also dharma stands as a resignification of artha and karma. Different from Stahl, however, I don't see the need to disqualify the subjective desire involved in the pursuance of dharma, and that would instead be counterproductive, in order to posit an ultimate intrinsic and self-reliable meaning of ritual as existential renunciation. In fact, the peculiar and unique nature of the positive desire involved, that is the acquisition of the transcendent paradise in next life, standing as it does in sharp contrast to the acquisition of mundane objects, demands a ritual process enveloped in a multi-layered renunciation that functions in the long term as an entrance gate for the pursuance of moksha. Going back to Katyayana's definitions of ritual and much to stall this belief, the Tyaga mentioned there, as Bodhevich has convincingly shown with reference to the Brahmanas and Kalpa Sutras, stands for the overall offerings required as counterparts for the future acquisition of paradise. One has to renounce something to get to paradise. That is overall material, dravya, attitudinal, diksha, upasana, and mental sacrifices one has to go through as the sacrifices renunciation to a fundamental dimension of one's self-identity, which I classified as the mama dimension of ahankara. In several Brahmanas, these various dimensions of renunciation are explicitly said to constitute a representation or a presentation of the sacrificer himself, the Yajamana. In other words, the sacrificial victim, the object of renunciation, the offering, is, in the ultimate analysis, a dimension of the sacrificer himself. Now, the major dimensions of the renunciation involved in dharmic ritual, I would classify them into two basic categories. And I think it's important to concentrate on this. First, the renunciation of objective dimensions of one's mundanity, artha and kama, in form of material offerings and exceptional behaviorally change. As any other form of endeavor, this dharmic aspect represents the cost in one's bargain, in negotiating, in achieving, in buying the paradise. But there is a second one, and that's why I want to draw the attention for this. The renunciation of the immediate enjoyment, here and now, in this life, of the expected paradise. The putative goal of all Vedic ritual actions, and the acceptance that the specific nature of the transcendent object demands, it means paradise, quite different from the mundane objects, earth and karma, a time gap of one's entire present existence for the results to emerge in a future life, paratra. It's important to note that this sounds close to Stahl's proposition, and yet it does not mean, as Stahl suggests, that actual renunciation is of the desire for paradise. One does not renounce, one acts because of this desire. But one accepts that in this life he is not going to have the return of his payment. So he's not going to have the paradise during his life. So he is kind of doing a long-term investment with a certain indetermination because it's not previsible in time, it's another life. So he has to look at all his entire life after renouncing to certain material aspects of his life without having the actual return or expected return, which is the paradise. To address appropriately the above two categories of renunciation, we need first to expand our investigation into the general aspects of Vedic ritual injunctions that purportedly lead one to paradise. We should state at the outset that notwithstanding the plurality of designative goals, some of them even contemplating worldly matters, the uniqueness of Vedic ritual tradition lies in the fact that the real putative goal of them all is the acquisition of paradise. Echoing the necessary implications of Jamini's above-mentioned definition of ritual, scholar Getcher states, even if the results are not specifically mentioned in the context of a particular sacrificial act, the result will be Svarga. This means that the central aspect of Dharma, where the subjective desire for self-transformation and the imperative commands of the Vedas converge, is to be found in the so-called Kamya Karmas, that is, the sacrificial rituals of optional character that are the seeds of putative future results, that produce karma, as sometimes we say, agami karma, in the form of paradise. They constitute this kamya karma, the central object of the description and prescription of the brahmanas and their smritis follow-ups, the Shrauta Sutras in particular. Ancillary to them are the so-called nitya karmas, more often the object of the Dharma Sutras and the Grahiya Sutras, daily or seasonal rites that possess a sheer mandatory character, since they constitute the derivative results of past actions. So they are related to the other karma called prarambha karma. Though their observance of these nitya karmas is not productive of future results, their non-observance may be productive of negative results, being as a consequence indirectly associated with the major interested actions related to the search for paradise. The concept of paradise, the second issue regarding this structure, this Vedic structure about the ritual. The concept of paradise, Svarga, that instigates one to perform the Vedic ritual is far from the Christian idea of a pre-existent and objective place. It's what I call a concept limit. It constitutes the linguistic point of convergence of all desires for a transformed condition of existence that may bring about incremental happiness, that is, a minimization of suffering and a more lasting objective enjoyment. It being so, the paradise of ritual literature is a linguistic concept or sign without a definite external referent and whose ultimate relevance lies in its efficacy of driving one towards action. This means it's not a specific representational word. It stands for anything I want to improve my existential condition and therefore to achieve happiness. So whatever I say I want to be happy or more happy than what I am now, this is the paradise. And the Brahmanas are not committed to describe the paradise, only to use this word as a, let us say, a word without referent to convey that motivational desire for happiness and prompt one to, in fact, act towards the paradise. This brings us to the fundamental idea that the paradise is a product, that is, a reality yet to be, and non-existence before. That is one of the meanings of the word apurva. And that the ritual is its manufacturing plant. I call it the factory to produce paradise, the immediate and sufficient cause for its production, managed and directed by the sacrificer's main task of assembling In the right time and space, all the necessary factors involved in accordance with the injunctive passages of the Vedas. So, as the focal point that make the bridge between the text and performance, Vedic injunctions earn precedence over mantras and arthavadas. So, Vedic tradition, the Vedic ritual tradition, what it matters is the injunction which is at stake. Mantras, for instance, Rig Veda, but if obviously it's just one, and arthavadas, I mean sentences which not necessarily point up to injunctions, are to be understood for the sake of injunctions. These later, it means the mantras and the arthavadas, mythical and panegyric stories of gods and goddesses, function primarily as exhortative words rather than actual revelation of metalinguistic entities. As such, instead of mythological dramatizations appealing to gods' propitiatory retribution, rituals subordinate those very gods to the requirements of renunciation, making them the nominal repositories of the sacrificer's offerings. Shabra puts it in this way, rather dramatic. Vedic gods exist as Vedic words. Beyond that, it's not the goal of the text. It's not denying their ontological existence, but here they function as words. They are words. It's interesting to note that contrary to what is often thought, the growth and development of theistic devotional traditions and subsequent emergence of simplified versions of yajna, for instance, the contemporary pujas, do not necessarily compromise with these renunciatory fundamentals of the Vedic ritual framework. In fact, as personifications of the Vedas, Vishnu or Shiva, for example, act as repositories of offerings with greater efficiency and above all with greater transparency as regards the actual source of transformational authority. In fact, the Supreme God's grace, instead of shattering the Vedic emphasis on personal effort, coexists intimately with the latter by entrusting the Vedic or Pauranic injunctions, I call it the Veda's grace, with a rather dialogical, intimate, and flexible overtone. After all, as Rupa Goswami puts it, bhakti is anushilana, repeated practice and meditation, and not mere subjective emotionalism. Now, the motivating and productive power of Vedic injunctions as a means to lead one to paradise is similar to a magic event, whereby words are productive of meanings as ritual actions. In a rather complex fashion, whereby the fruition of their expected results are deferred for a period after life. The notion of utpatika, used by Jaimini to describe the nature of the Vedic relationship between word and meaning, stands precisely for that. Its usual translation as innate, it means the innate relation between word and meaning, demands further qualifications. Instead of a relationship that links two pre-existing levels of reality, as we understand usually magic, there are two levels of reality affecting one, I affect the other. In this case, one linguistic and another empirical, the injunctive word of the Vedas, the Brahmanas here I'm talking, as orality enshrined in a discipular tradition, implies seminally a relationship in succession between two terms, the materiality of the word and the actions it leads to. In other words, the full realization of meaning of the word depends on the actual performance of the ritual action and the unfoldment of its expected consequences. Therefore, this pregnant character of Vedic ritual word stands vindicated on the grounds of its actual efficacy, and as such, it is said to be free from any subjective intentionality or authorship. That's precisely what the word Apurusheya means as a complementary characteristics of Vedic ritual language. As Mohanty states, the authorlessness of Shruti, speaking in a general sense, including the Upanishads, but I'm here concentrating on the Brahmanas, means for me minimally the following. In the case of texts such as the Shruti, the intention of the author is not relevant for understanding the texts. The text is primary and autonomous because it is pragmatically effective in producing transformation. We are now in better position to address the two basic categories of renunciation above presented. The first category means renunciation to objective dimensions of one's mundanity, karma and earth, comprehends two basic categories, subcategories. The first subcategory has a general character and stands as a sort of prerequisite or purification to any ritual endeavor. It includes Shraddha and Swadhyaya. Shraddha, I call it the principle of self-conviction, asserts the necessity of entertaining an unwavering faith in the Vedas, and more specifically in the efficacy of a ritual action that enjoined. As stated in the Kaushatika Brahmana, the ritual of he who performs it with conviction, with Shraddha, is not susceptible to perish. That is, it leads to the achievement of the paradise. Moreover, as stated in the Apastamba Shraddha Sutta, unwavering self-conviction is also a fundamental ingredient to ensure, during the actual performance of the ritual, a solid concentration, dharana, on the intended transcendent object, keeping the mind away from any subreptitious interference of worldly matters. The second, Swadhyaya, the explicit injunction for the study and systematic inquiry into the Vedic texts themselves, as a means to prepare oneself beforehand to the various acts involved in the performance of the prescribed rituals. Considering the extreme subtlety of the subject matter, it deals, as it does, with the invisible, in the sense not that it lies elsewhere, but is invisible, adrishta, because it's apurva, not yet existence. The paradise is invisible because it's not yet existent. So it is a subtle matter. So because of this extreme subtle matter, the Shatapatha Brahmana ranks the study of the text as a fundamental requisite for the efficacy of a ritual. Prachina Yoga, the master, one of the gurus mentioned in the text, states emphatically, if upon placing the offerings in the Agnihotra ritual, you are conscious of the motive whereby the spoon, for example, should be stirred after placing the offering, then you will have actually done the offering. But if you do it without being conscious of this fact, in this case, you will not have done the offering. Now, the second subcategory of this first renunciation to mundane aspects of life, the second subcategory has a specific character and comprehends, again, two major subcategories. Diksha, the initiatory rites, and Dana Dakshina Ahuti, which are different words to reflect, to express the material offerings. The first subcategory, Diksha, consists of rites by means of which the sacrificer is said to assume symbolically an extra human or divine status. It includes the temporary suspensions of mundane activities that mostly include sexual abstinence, restrictions on sociability, work and eating, practice of meditation and concentration, and reading of sacred texts. The second subcategory includes all the material objects being offered to the major interlocutors involved in the ritual, gods, priests, and prominent personalities of one's community. So you have Ahuti, Dakshina, and Dana. The momentous event that is emblematic of all those acts of relinquishing one's valuable assets is the placement of the sacred oblations in the sacrificial fire, while uttering the following words, as probably you know, Agneye Dam Namama, which means, this is for the god fire, this is not mine. Again, this is a sentence which is commented by Stahl, and he really interprets that the statement of not being mine refers to the fruits of the ritual. It makes no sense. What he's saying is that when I place the thing in, for anyone who has practiced one of these rituals, I'm saying this thing which I'm handing over, I'm relinquished, this is not mine. This is going to be transformed, you know, and given and offered to the gods, to the agency and mediation of the fire. Agnayedam namama. It should finally be mentioned that the imperative need of one's performance of the ritual and of one's renunciation of material and mental assets of this world, it means the karma and earth, takes precedence over what is actually to be done and which offering is actually to be given. In fact, not only has the Vedic tradition developed within itself a plurality of ritual and exegetical variants, the shakas, the sampradayas, that tend to conform to historical, regional, community, and individual diversities, but above all, it's a very important thing, the specific prescription enjoined are also equally open to alternatives in the form of the so-called principle of substitution, pratinidhitva, whereby specific rites, instruments, offering, places, dates may be circumstantially set aside, that is, they may be eventually replaced by substitutes. The real motto here seems to be, do perform the ritual, no matter how. We reach now the last point of our lecture, and that's where the second category of renunciation comes into picture. I call it renunciation of the immediate enjoyment of the paradise. I'm not saying renunciation of the paradise. Again, it should be a paradox. So the acceptance that you're not going to enjoy it in this life, the renunciation of the immediate enjoyment here and now and throughout the entire life of the expected paradise, the putative goal of all Vedic rituals. And we also stated before that here lies the uniqueness of Dharma as a doorway for the re-signification of one's mundane life, and further ahead, a doorway for the ultimate pursuance of moksha. How does this happen? In other words, what's after all the substantive content of the Dharma's immediate efficacy or intrinsic goal, since it is Dharma rather than the paradise, the actual Purushartha? The answer to this question is key for one to understand the fundamental ethics that underscores Vedic ritual and its intrinsic and ultimate capability to transform the sacrificer's egoistic relationship with the world into a more comprehensive and compassionate one. Such deconstructive task that hits fundamentally the mind, I said already, the mama, of one's self-identity, is but the other side of the same magic that purports to engender paradise. A rather unexpected and extraordinary magic, perhaps the meaningfulness of Stahl's meaninglessness. It means the actual efficacy of Dharma, not the later paradise. Let us recollect for a moment that the actual acquisition of the paradise does not follow chronologically the aftermath of the ritual performance that in turn constitutes the former paradise sufficient cause. To explain this extraordinary or extra mundane temporal gap between cause and effect, traditional mimamsakas have postulated the existence of an intermediate link called apurva. Again, not yet existent, so it is a different meaning but contiguous of the previous one. It means the svarga, the paradise, is apurva, not yet, is apurva, not yet existent, and it is apurva because between its actual fruition and the end of the ritual, which is the ultimate cause of its production, there is a gap of time in which something is generated like a seed, like a passport, which adheres to the sacrificer, which will enable him to experience it later on in the afterlife. So this apurva is a kind of seed or passport that sticks to the sacrificer and is conducive to the future enjoyment of the paradise in an afterlife condition. The seed or potency of this non-yet-existent, and therefore, as I said, imperceptible paradise, does not, however, affect the sufficient character of the ritual as its cause. In other words, although the actual enjoyment of the sacrifice is deferred, the performance of the ritual remains as a sufficient productive condition for the former's final appearance. Meantime, what is the sacrificer's condition in this very immediate life? On the one hand, he has renounced to the actual ownership of material and mental goods, the so-called mundane objectives of karma and dharma. And on the other, he did it so as an exchange for the much-desired paradise, whose fruition he knows will only take place after life. His situation is therefore sui generis. He is bound to live his life without both the once private mundane objects and the desired transcendent object that, till the date its actually privatization or possession takes place, remains a chimerical entity, a mere word. It's precisely here, in this rare existential vacuum, that an existential opportunity for self-transformation emerges. On the one hand, one tends to admit the possibility of an otherwise unthinkable situation. One may live and survive without both. And on the other, one may discover that living without the once private mundane object is not tantamount to do not live or coexist with them at all. After all, different from the deferred paradise, the mundane objects are here, part of the same world, ready to be resignified as mere othernesses rather than private othernesses, and consequently freed from the egoistic designs that tend to obscure their true nature. This epistemological, I call it sacralization of the mundane, does not happen at once. In the Indian context of transmigration, this may involve a span of many lives, both in human and paradisiacal forms, during which the combination of two categories of qualitative experiences may favor the consolidation of a definitive self-transformation. These two qualitative experiences. The first category of qualitative experience is the realization through suffering and reflection of the ephemeral and contingent nature of the paradises actually acquired and experienced. In fact, having been produced from the merits generated by ritual performance, the paradises are said to be bound to be extinct by the unavoidable exhaustions of those merits. This, in turn, opens the way for new rebirths in the human condition, as the narrative goes. The second category of qualitative experience is the realization that the continued interaction with, I call it, sacralized mundane objects, means mundane objects resignified by the gradual purging of one's egoistic distortion. It means I have to continue to deal and to interact with, but without being mine, because I have renounced to them. Tends to be, it means that this sacralized mundane objects, resignified by the gradual purging of one's egoistic distortions, tends to be less painful, more pleasurable, and of mutual benefit. The combination of these two processes entrusts the dynamics of transmigration with what I call the character of an ethical pedagogy of the self through renunciation. Therefore, more than a channel of communication between the sacred and the profane, through the mediation of the object of renunciation, as anthropologists Herbert and Moss defined it, the ritual sacrifice constitutes in the very long term an instance of openness to the viability of the sacred within the profane, the immanent paradise. From the epistemological perplexities that emerge from and because of what renunciation entails, Dharmic ritual action is made to point to something existentially over and above its original function of producing contingent paradises in afterlife. It posits an existential space of ethical realization, which is expressed in the sacrifices, renunciation of a dimension of the self. It's from here that emerges the organic link between Dharma and Moksha. In fact, the qualitative experiences above mentioned represent a necessary breakthrough in form of Vairagya and Viveka, the two most important qualifications for the knowledge of the Upanishads, to take forward the partial renunciation and consequent, I call it, deprivatization of otherness, and enable the pursuance of complete renunciation that will primarily focus on the deconstructing of the I and the consequent desubstantialization of otherness and subject-object relationship, and the final realization of the ontological, non-dual, dependent, or interdependent nature of reality. And here we enter the final domain of human soteriology designs, demanding distinct pedagogical structures, qualifications, and literary sources, the Upanishads, and whose scope lies beyond the limits of this lecture. It's interesting to note, however, that prominent Mimamsaka authors such as Kumarila and Prabhakara, whose primary commitment is with Dharma and one's search for the paradise, have both intuition, or had this fundamental insight and wrote about that the ultimate way to overcome suffering lies beyond objective enjoyments and demands a critical revision and ultimate renunciation to the notion of an interested agent. For Kumarila and Prabhakara, the latter coming quite close to Stahl's major insight, though not mentioned in connection with that by Stahl himself, the pursuance of moksha demands the relinquishing of all interested actions, the kamya karmas. It's finally in the Vedantin tradition, from Shankaracharya to Madhvacharya, that the cognitive background of renunciation, that is a supreme knowledge of the ontological non-difference, dependence, or interdependence between Atman and Brahma through either Karma Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, or Jnana Yoga, is made more explicit. Shankaracharya's non-dual position is then summed up in the following words: how can the notions of agent and enjoyers persist after the realization I am Brahma? Thank you.
Save them for a later conversation, maybe, and let somebody else
ask something. So, in the oldest texts, moksha is not really present. I think, as far as I can tell, it's only with the early Upanishads or maybe the Buddhist literature that the idea of going beyond heaven, which is what moksha seems to be, taking yourself out of the game completely, becomes to be prevalent and recognized as a goal. So I'm wondering, when, according to you, do you think the concept of moksha first arises, and where does it come from? Is it a natural development from Vedic ritual theorizing?
You can see that by my approach, I would not dare to establish any kind of historical emergency of what is to be necessarily and a spontaneous demand of one's existence, even though it is not necessarily expressive every time or in every life. So there may be circumstances which justify why certain things are not seen in some moments. But I understand and I stick by that structure of Dharma and Moksha is a kind of archetypical structure of human existence.
Could Dharma be looked at these rituals? First, you start off with the kamya karma, because like in the Ramayana, they want sons. So you have the Puranas where there is a lot of rituals are performed for a particular reason, either acquisition of power, acquisition of children, and so on. But the discipline of doing the rituals in a very strict prescribed manner helps you to learn to concentrate, so that the next ritual you perform, you actually are not you concentrate on the discipline and so on. And even though you're giving the dhana, the ahuti, dakshina, and the dhana and everything else, you begin to realize as you keep performing one yajna after the yajna that the results, even though when done as prescribed, happens, but they don't last. So then it's like this little story where the father asks the son to go and bring water in an old basket which contained coal, and he goes, the son comes back and he repeats, never could get enough water. And eventually the son, after tempting it 20 times, he says, Father, why did you ask me to do this? He said, look at the basket. It's now a clean basket. It was dirty before, now it is clean. So in some ways, these rituals probably help to purify the mind. to
yes,
that?
Yes, I think it's more or less. I think it's this. But on the other hand, it means that the explicit goal of the ritual is not anything of this life. And therefore, I think this experience you're talking about does not need rituals in the sense that we live systematically acquiring and losing objects of desire. And therefore, if we are minimally reflexive about that experience, we can start thinking that there is some problem with us and not exactly with the world itself. But then we tend to then reify the possibility of resolving this existential dilemma in transcendental objects. And then the ritual is going to treat about these transcendental objects, which is of one who already projected the insufficiencies of one existential attempts to achieve happiness in this world for another world. And is going to do it in such a way that in the long term, the paradise itself is going to be deconstructed.
Where does Sharanagati come here?
Where?
Sharanagati. The concept of Ramanuja's Sharanagati. That I'll do everything, but since I've surrendered myself to Narayana, he will decide whether I get it or not. But that is my Sharanagati. So where does Sharanagati come in relation to rituals?
I mean, I've called it a partial renunciation. No? Here we are talking about a moksha perspective. Mm. So this can only happen in a context in which you are dealing with the concept of I, and not merely with asking you to renounce to certain things. We all are ready to renounce to our possessions. The question is when someone asks us to renounce of ourselves. And I think this perspective of Ramanuja relates to the second dimension. Here I'm talking about of a more, let us say, immediate dimension of renunciation, which coexists with another desire, objective desire. I'm not asking you to renounce everything. On the contrary, I only go to the paradise because, to the ritual because I want the paradise. So explicitly, I have a subjective desire for something. So I'm not surrendering myself to the realization of the performance of the sacrifice.
To pick up on what was in some sense already asked, I think there is some, at least it seems to be an implicit notion that there's an unbroken tradition from like the Mimamsa Sutras onwards to the Vedanta Sutras in some sense. And you pointed out that some of the texts that you mentioned, Kalpa Sutras, Mimamsa Sutras, and the Brahmanas before that. And if at least in the reading of those texts, I like my colleague already pointed out, that there's in a sense no mention of liberation or moksha, but a realization of dharma. And at least the Mimamsa Sutras, according to Jaimini, at least seems to be interested in expounding the centrality of the act itself and then finding a reason or a telos for that act when it was questioned by the Buddhists and the upcoming even within the tradition itself. When ritual practices were beginning to question, it seemed as if he was trying to give an intelligibility for the importance of the act and the centrality of the act itself. And so I at least in my brief sketches, it felt that he was talking about, particularly talking about realizing dharma in the action, in the ritual practices, rather than the telos of liberation or moksha, etc., which I don't think he really mentions. Except later, maybe mentioned by later Mimamsakas, I'm not sure. But even the concept of God and paradise is mentioned very differently. And you especially mentioned paradise, and in some sense, the goal that cannot be realized, but in this life. But he does mention, Jaimini at least does mention goals that can be realized in this life as well. And so, and like you mentioned, paradise itself is a word that the, in some sense it's an injunction rather than a real objective.
He may speak about many things, but he is a commentator of the Vedas, and the Vedas have that justification and their uniqueness to speak to someone about something you cannot have from anywhere else. And what they are unique about is the achievement of paradise, and not obviously of other worldly and mundane goals that eventually may be and are also, let us say, collateral dimensions of all rituals. But what is putative for all Vedic rituals is the search for something which is transcendent. And that's exactly what justifies intervention. As far as the speaking or not speaking, that is absolutely normal. It should be like this only. See, you would surprise, I mean, I would recommend that the history of Vedanta, that of Hajime Nakamura. And the chapter, he speaks about exactly the Purva Mimamsa and relations with Uttara Mimamsa. Not only he puts in his indetermination about the actual, I mean, structure of this dual dimension or dual step dimension of what we call the Vedic religion, but also he says that Jaimini is, according to some traditions in India, on the one hand, conversant with all the Upanishads, and he does not speak about them. And on the other hand, even arguably, is the author of the Vedanta Sutras, of the Brahma Sutras. There is another line of tradition which says that he wrote the Mimamsa Sutras, but he also wrote. But does not even need that. I mean, it's just the fact that he was conversant also with the Upanishads and does not speak. Why? Because his subject is Dharma. But he is aware that Dharma is not the means to achieve liberation. And therefore, he is conversant with another stage of one's existence where, with other orientations, guidances, and literatures, this goal is achieved. And just abide it that that tradition that attributes to Jaimini exactly the writing up of the two Vedantas is extremely significant and meaningful and emblematic of this. So the question is not whether the Mimamsakas speak of moksha. They should not. In fact, when I finished my article, I was saying that it was a little bit unexpected. And that's perhaps justifies Shankaracharya's reaction, in the sense that the Mimamsaka, like Jaimini, was not supposed to speak about moksha. But maybe it was not his field, let us say, of expertise, and he's talking about Dharma. But some Mimamsakas subsequently, yes. And therefore they enter in conflict with a certain other perspective, which is in the case Shankaracharya's perspective. But even those, and I mentioned here, Kumarli and Prabhakara, they are not speaking about moksha through the rituals. They are going to propose the abandonment of the fundamental ritualistic tradition of the Kamya Karmas. So they are going to speak about only performing what we call the Nitya Karmas, which is not exactly what is enjoyed by the Brahmanas, which is Kamya Karmas. So I don't think that that would be a problem. It would be perhaps a matter to question, as far as historical history is concerned, the records of those who wrote about moksha, let us say. Okay? But in fact, I think we should do not necessarily attribute meaning to what we cannot necessarily understand or find as far as historical developments are concerned. First of all, in the sense of a chronology of one's life, Dharma comes first. We are also in oral traditions where not everything is recorded. But necessarily, there is a chronology individually located of Dharma being first. That does not mean historically. It means there is a recurrence in one's life, in any person who is born tomorrow, that the sequence is Dharma and moksha. And therefore, it means what is primary, natural of one existence is Dharma. Just see in the Indian context that not only for Dharma, but for moksha, you need qualifications. Which means that you don't have the same qualifications for Dharma and moksha. And the qualifications for moksha are much more, in some sense, restrictive, because they depend on certain events that have to take place in regard to Dharma. I think the idea of eligibility is also important. Sometimes we forget this. Yeah.
If you'd like to stay and continue the discussion, feel free to do so. But I'd just like to thank Dilip again for this thought-provoking talk.